Sound Podcast. I'm Andrew McGregor, and with each installation in this podcast, we're going to explore the world of spirituality, what it means to be alive, and how is it that we can bring our spiritual selves, tarot, meditation, religious or spiritual practices, into our daily lives. Please check out all of our episodes at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts, or you can search The Hermit's Lamp in podcasts on iTunes and download them all directly that way. If you are looking for card-by-card instruction on reading the tarot, please consider checking out James Wells and my new audio project, The Trumps Card-by-Card, where we dig in deep to one of the major cards and explore it thoroughly. If that sounds exactly like what you're looking for and gets your tarot juices all fired up, you can certainly also find that at thehermitslamp.com/podcasts. So welcome to another episode of The Hermit's Lamp Podcast. I'm here with Camilla Elias, and we are going to talk about some card reading stuff for sure, as well as we're going to talk about folk magic. And, you know, how that relates to card reading, how that relates to spirituality in general, and, you know, what we might have to learn from these kind of more pragmatic and earthy kind of spiritual and magical practices. So for those who don't know you, perhaps you can do a quick introduction of yourself, Camilla.
All right. Thank you very much. Let me just thank you for this opportunity. Although I'm not so keen on doing interviews, you know, I have to just grant you, when you said, let's make Ryan happy, you know, on my card students, I couldn't resist. So you did push the right button.
Excellent.
But yes, I am a professor of American studies here in Denmark, in Roskilde, very close to Copenhagen. I have been interested in, divination, sacred and secret texts. So, you know, I'm in the fortunate position where I can actually combine what I get paid to do, you know, research into cultural and literary texts, you know, pertaining to modes of spiritualities with my own practice of reading cards, divination, a bit of magic, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's my door into this world, you know, basically through my academic work.
Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about the reading the cards, I know you read everything, but when I'm I've seen you read tarot, I've seen you read playing cards and, you know, other things, right? What's your preferred kind of deck or modality? What's exciting you about those things these days?
That's a good question. I get this one all the time. But okay, so depending on the context, let's just say if I read for people, in the professional sense, meaning that I actually get paid, you know, to offer some kind of words of wisdom, then I go for the Tarot de Marseille. So I always read either with just the majors, the Tarot de Marseille, or I read with a full deck, depending on the question, the context of the question or the situation. Now, if you ask me about my family, you know, I have a family who's also interested in divination and card reading and all that. And insofar as I collect a few interesting decks, though I can't call myself a collector because, you know, I buy the decks and then I just read them to death, as I like to put it. So, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think there will be in any kind of mint condition, if you like, after I die, you know, that everybody will be thinking, oh, whoa, you know, we just got some very nice decks, because I use all of them. So, you know, with my family, we read oracles. My sister is a very good Lenormand cards reader. My partner is also very good with the Marseille Tarot, but also the pixie deck, as she likes to call it. She likes the Rider-Waite-Smith deck. So I also occasionally read with those, but it's mainly in the context of a family gathering, you know, and we just have a bit of fun, or not just fun, you know, I mean, I like to call it the fun that is also wise at the same time, because, you know,
sure.
There is always some kind of revelation at the end of any kind of game or whatever you have to call it. So, you know, for people I read the Tarot de Marseille, or if I have a specific request, I read the Lenormand cards. And then I have quite a few, again, depending on the here, the nationality. Say, although I've been living in Denmark for 25 years, I come originally from Romania. And the Romanians, the ones I grew up with, they have always read with the playing cards, the playing cards. Mm-hmm. So say if I have people contacting me, requesting a reading, then they will more often than not go for playing cards. So, you know, again, depending on who I'm dealing with, then I choose the deck accordingly. Yeah.
Excellent. I like the idea of the family gathering where perhaps there's also some wisdom as well. You know, my wife and I got a sitter in the other day. We had one of these days because I have a 5 and a 7 year old, right? And nice. You know, the kids were basically just driving us crazy, and we called our sitter and we're like, we're having a horrible day. Is there any chance you're free right now? Because we really really just need to get away for a little bit, right? And so what did we do? We went out, we had some food, and then we went to a coffee shop and broke out the cards, and for like 2 hours, you know, just asked questions and explored stuff and planned our lives and dreamed and talked and, you know, had this sort of completely open-ended process to it where at the end, some of it was silly, you know, questions asked in joke, we'd answer anyway. And some of it was very serious and, you know, we kind of adjusted our plans and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what, maybe the other thing I haven't mentioned is that, well, if we talk about the family gathering, then we also have a very, I would like to say, good appreciation of the art decks. Uh-huh. So, you know, we read what others have called wisdom decks, but then we also just look at cards that are very interesting from an artistic point of view, or because of the way in which they have been crafted. So, you know, in that sense, you don't really look for any kind of esoteric meaning or although, you know, that is always there and it's somewhere, you know, it informs everything or just a mode of divination. But what we like to do is see how different the divining session, let's just call it that, you know, gets to be different from, let's say, when you have a context where you just lay down the Marseille cards, which in my opinion are so precise. You know, I like them because they're so sharp. Mm-hmm. They're so crisp, you know, and you are never in doubt as to what's happening in a Marseille deck, you know. So we also look a lot at cards that are not only interesting from the point of view of the art, you know, or what kind of artist statement we may be dealing with, but then also from their cultural significance. So I'm quite interested in why we have such a proliferation of the tarot decks, you know. You have everything. There is no phenomenon out there for which there isn't a tarot deck represents. So I'm quite interested in, like, who are these people, you know, who want to have their interests or push an agenda, maybe, you know, mirror these agendas or their interests. You know, we have so many thousands or hundreds, you know, feminist decks, just to give an example. Homosexual, you know, gay people's decks, you know. A baseball tarot.
Sure.
So sometimes we just look at the cultural significance of some of these decks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a store here in Toronto, and I've been, you know, running it for about 4 years now. And, you know, I mean, and I've been into tarot for almost 30 years. And, it, you know, I regularly get phone calls where someone's like, do you have this deck? And I'm like, I've never even heard of that deck, you know, and I'll look, and it's been around for 10 years. Like, it's not like it's a new thing, you know, and I got to Google it and see what's going on. So yeah, so many things. Mm-hmm. So how does the practice of folk magic, come into this part of your life, or where does that come from? Is that part of your family tradition? Mm.
That is a good question, you know, and although I may want to make some claims, at least, you know, I can't really say that we did any of that in my family, although, you know, actually, I think I just recently, you may have come across it, we just had sorry for plugging this now, we just had the book, The Magiculum, edited by Todd Landman, a book where he gathers several voices, you know, from the mentalist scene, you know, where you have the stage magicians to some other magicians that dive into folklore. So I was just making a few references to how, although my father was very good with folklore and magic, but you know, it's more like it's a household remedy. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a fever. I think in that example, in my essay in that book, I mentioned how once I just had a high fever. And, well, I was very little. I think I was about 3 or 4. And nobody could figure out how to bring it down. So I had been through all the medical checks and all that, and there was a bit of excitement, you know. So is she gonna live? Or quite to that point, you know. So my father decided, oh, the hell with all the doctors, you know. Now I'm gonna do what I know may have a good, may yield some good results. So he simply just made me drink a glass of water into which he threw three matches that he had burnt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, although I was so young, it's in fact one of my few memories of my father. He died when I was 8, unfortunately. But, you know, that one, I really treasure it because I still remember the smell of the water, you know, of some, I don't know what the matches, you know.
The sulfur and the ash and...
Yeah, exactly. You know, there was a very poignant smell. So he made me drink that water, and then lo and behold, you know, how would we catalog that, you know, as part of my magical upbringing, or did I live with this? Or so I prefer to think of this as just some very local, specific events, you know, and I can't really claim that there was a very conscious line going through it, you know, where you could say, oh, we did this all the time, because that is not exactly, and I think that this is quite general in the, when we talk about folk magic, that most of these practitioners of these household remedies, that I like to call them, they never think of it, of what they're doing as being magic, you know. Mm-hmm. So to them, it's because it's so practical, because it's so, you know, a down-to-earth, and the more technology develops, you know, the more people actually, scientists, you know, figure out that, oh, you know, what was good 1,000 years ago can now be explained in scientific terms. So, you know, and why? Again, lo and behold, because more often than not, what we're dealing with here is a very commonsensical approach to life and illness, if you like. So, you know, a lot of this can be explained, the use of herbs, the use of... Now, of course, you know, if you think, well, why would three matches lit and then thrown into a glass of water? How is that possible? You know, so I don't think I have an answer to that. But it goes to show, you know, some things were. And my mother used to be very good at divining, especially bibliomancy. So, and coffee beans, I don't know, coming from Romania, I really, in a way, I feel a bit like, you know, you hear so many claims around and who's doing what, and it's so important to establish a certain lineage. And so I'm a bit cautious, you know, with my claims. Mm-hmm. So I don't really want to say anything other than the fact that perhaps, I don't think there was a day when I didn't see some cards on the table, but mainly people were using playing cards for divination. And although I do know some people in Romania who also owned a few tarot decks in the Marseille tradition. The Rider-Waite Smith was not so popular. And... yeah, so I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of like sidetracked now. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Was this something I grew up with? I don't know. So, well, so yeah, yes and no. Yeah, yes and no. So, you know,
For my experience of folk magic traditions is that they are sort of inherently syncretic. They'll just absorb anything, you know? Yeah. And, you know, when I first started reading professionally, the store that I read at was, 75-80% Caribbean. And mm-hmm. so I spent years hanging out with a lot of people from Jamaica, St. Lucia, you know, Trinidad, Guyana and West Africa. and reading for these people and talking with these people. And, you know, the thing that I heard all the time, you know, the almost go-to statement was they'd grab something or they'd point at something in the shop or they'd bring something in with it. Like, what is this good for? What does this do for me? You know, and it's like they were interviewing it for a position in their company. You know, it's like, I need someone who's going to remove fevers. You got someone for that? Who's good for that? You know, so, and again, that very, very, it's not like it was anything. It was just, you know, oh, well, we tried this, we tried that. Okay, now we'll go see Andrew, and now we'll go do whatever, and we'll do some work in another way to see what we can do for it. So,
well, you know, some of this area has been documented. Maybe I can just mention one of my favorite books, and this is written by Emma Wilby. Maybe some people know about it. It's called Cunning Folk and Familiar Spirits. And one of the things that she does in that book is combining some of the visionary, shamanistic visionary traditions in early modern British tradition with sympathetic magic, or the, like you are mentioning, house, the syncretism, you know, where it's just absorbed. Traditions, they just tend to be absorbed and then passed on in an oral form of transmission. So, you know, it's a bit difficult to talk about it, but then, I can, according to these kind of histories that some people write about, this is a rather well documented area, you know, of how, yeah, the woman on the hedge, you know, the last house in the village,
mm-hmm.
And everything else would fail, you would go and visit her because she would have some knowledge of herbs. Or again, what strikes me whenever I read these kind of books is, in fact, the very commonsensical approach to everything, right? In some other traditions, this is called low magic, right? So this, sorry, but I don't mean to sound, you know, yeah. So, but you know, let's just say that if one makes a reference to the literature or the ways in which people define the difference between high magic and low magic, then what people point to is the fact that high magic, you know, is embodied by the white male guys, you know, the ceremonial magicians, whereas low magic, you know, is the field that's populated by the cunning, wise woman, old woman, the crone, if you like, the one who knows some things about herbs and maybe is not so rigid in terms of how she devises her rituals. But now we kind of got sidetracked again.
Well, I think that the notion of, you know, rigidity, because, I mean, my background, I spent, you know, I mean, all my teen years and most of my 20s studying high magic, right? You know, studying Crowley, studying Golden Dawn, studying all that jazz, right? And, you know, I certainly, especially when I was younger, was way more into this sort of formal idea that one could know. You know what I mean? You go, you pull out the tomes off your shelf and you sort through the correspondences and you create something and you know, it's like this is right or this is true or these are, you know, these kinds of ideas. And when we migrate over into folk magic, the cunning traditions and these other things, you don't necessarily know anything. I mean, sometimes you do, right? But, you know, as we were talking, I was thinking about, you know, my experience of folk magic and cunning magic is it's kind of this intersection of prayers and religion, of spirit and spirits, ancestral or otherwise, and then physical stuff. And we can't go and to a book and pull out and be like, oh, I mean, in your dad's case, in the example, then certainly he had a piece of knowledge that he accessed and used. But yeah, often these things are specific, you know, and they are context specific, and that is their power, right?
That's it. Mm-hmm. But this is actually, I mean, before the internet kind of had a failure, the Skype. What I wanted to say was that this area is very documented and that the cunning folks, they used to be quite revered and respected. So in that sense, you know, one can sense that although there isn't, we don't have many written records of the practices, insofar as that they have all been transmitted orally, more or less, we do have some sense of, you know, how this happened, precisely because everything was so grounded, if you like, you know. So we're not yet dealing with any kind of, astral plane. So this is yet one of the other major differences between high magic and low magic. Here we are dealing literally with the telluric forces, you know, the earth, you know, mm-hmm. Ashes to ashes, somewhere that awareness that we come from this earth and we're part of it informs everything that we get to see is significant in low magic. So, you know, yeah, going back to my father, one of the other examples that I love to mention is that he used to take baths where he would beat himself up with fresh nettles. Now, you know, someone wow. Say, that sounds like it's tough, you know. And I actually remember his back, you know, like he would look like a lobster, I tell you, after like mm-hmm. five beatings and, you know, nobody would understand what the hell was going on. So he would fill a whole bathtub with lots of salt, and then he would pick these fresh nettles, and he would beat himself up vigorously with these fresh nettles. You know, so a lot of people would think that he was a mathematician, a trained mathematician, and he worked for the army. You know, so you'd say, well, what's a mathematician doing? You know, with engaging with these other so-called irrational solutions to maybe an ailment that can also perhaps be ascribed to a form of hypochondria. I don't know. His claim was that he was doing it because he's suffering from rheumatism, you know. So, okay. But I mean, obviously, the guy, he must have been in pain of some sort, otherwise he wouldn't have done it. But there you have it. So, you know, and somewhere I just think that when people engage in these very down-to-earth practices, they never really question the premise, you know, for why are they doing what they're doing?
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that the reason why we don't encounter as much speculation when we deal with the telluric forces or just using the earth, using the herbs and the plants, you know, it's simply because somewhere, I don't want to say intuitively because I'm a bit cautious of that word, but maybe somewhere we just have it ingrained in our own bodies. Our bodies somewhere remember that we come from this place, that we're part of it. A plant comes out of there, it's probably good, you know,
mm-hmm.
even when it is the poisonous kind. So, you know, so I think that what attracts me to that kind of folk magic is particularly this very connection, the fact that, you know, it's tangible, it's commonsensical. You walk on the stuff that you use, you know, you can actually, it's palpable, you hold it in your hand. So, you know, the magic in that sense becomes much more physical, yeah, like you were also saying. So, of course, I can go to bed and have some dreams or maybe engage in a ritual, high magic now, right? The high magic style ritual, and then call upon some whatever, and then get some impressions. And I'm sure there is also something very rewarding in that kind of approach. But if I have to state, you know, what my preference is, then I would have to say, just send me out into the woods, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or just, give me a bundle of plants so that I can beat myself up with, you know, or that kind of thing. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if all it takes for us, let's say, because I also come across this question, say, yeah, but how do you distinguish between an ordinary life where we do these things, you know, we make recourse to plants and the earth and whatever, we tread on it, and then the magical aspect. So, and to that, I really only have one answer, and that is awareness, you know. So as soon as you kick your awareness into realizing or just deciding, it's a matter of decision ultimately, that now I'm going to use these nettles on my back, you know, mm-hmm. in a magical way, then there is something that you activate on the perceptual level so that, you know, it kicks your experiential, if you like, feeling about what you're doing to a higher level. So basically you get bumped up to a higher level, you know. So you use
for
the
sure.
plan, as soon as you start thinking about what you're doing. So in a way, it does require that kind of ritualizing of your acts, because otherwise it's not magical, you see. So there has to be some kind of symbolic awareness about what you're doing. But still, what you're dealing with here, if there is an epiphany at the end of it, then you can bet that it's going to be of a very physical manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, I find, you know, I'll go for walks in the ravine, you know, by my store. You know, it's one of the things that I do, especially when I'm having issues, you know, whether that issue is emotional or physical or, you know, in terms of my luck, you know, these kinds of things, right? You know, I have this, I'm like, oh, I need to go for a walk in the woods. And then I'll go for a walk in the woods and I will find a spot, and it's often the same spot, but not always. Mm-hmm. And then I will sit there and I'll sit and I will feel that connection.
Yes.
And I will feel myself start to shift into other spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And then the birds, the wind, the movement of the plants, you know, whatever, will coalesce. And often there isn't an epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. often there is like, you know, collect a bunch of these, take them in a bundle, go sweep the floor of your shop. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And then I do. And then all of a sudden, whatever was the problem is gone, you know?
Yes.
And I think that sense of connection to nature is what, for me, what's really, really appealing about it, you know? I mean, and also the sort of imminence of it, you know? It's definitely, there is that decision, as you say. And then after that decision, if one is successful, there's that feeling of connection, which I think is as magical as the rest of the work itself, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. That's it. Well, you know, the only prerequisite, if you like, that needs to be in place is devising the time frame, you know, because otherwise the problem with going out in nature and, like you say, having some issue and then you go out and then you will start seeing signs all over the place, you know? And there is a bit of a danger with that because, you know, instead of having that beneficial effect, it will just merely confuse you unless you set the time frame. So you see, you know, there are always many more signs than we can mobilize. And therefore, say, deciding again that, okay, I'm going to go out in nature, I have an issue, and I'm going to sit on the stone for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as you do that, then you are ready to receive whatever impression, or rather decode it, because we are still relying very much on our faculty, cognitive faculties, you know, to decode and interpret and, you know. But within those 2 hours, you will be ready to be much more attuned or aware of that which comes to you. Or rather, you know, you'll be, how should I put it? You are more open to receiving what comes to you as a sign that is
sure.
more significant than if the same thing would occur, but which yet falls outside of the time frame.
It's just like when people come for a reading, they have decided that they're going to enter that space.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
So there's the amount of times I hear, you wouldn't believe the synchronous thing that happened to me on the way to see you. And I'm
yes.
like, of course I would, because you were looking for it, you know?
Yes, exactly. That's it. So, you know, so again, what we're talking about is really, it's not so mysterious or, you know, it's just common sense. It's an openness, you know, to being able to read, if you like, a pattern that may emerge within that time frame. And then, you know, you can allow yourself to have your own intuition, if you like, kick in, you know. So, but, you know, they have to work together. So, you know, for me, if intuition is not tagged, you know, to some form of pattern recognition or some kind of awareness, then it's just not good enough. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then it has a tendency to be a bit all over the place, you know, and I don't always rely just on the one, you know, or the other. So
for
to
sure.
me, in order for the magical act to work, you know, it requires a time frame. It requires for your awareness to be kicked in so that you can get bumped up to a higher level whenever you get an impression, or let's call it an epiphany, you know. I mean, if you are lucky, you can get those, you know. And then, you know, it's just perhaps to round it off, that feeling of being grateful and thankful. Mm-hmm. So just as when you would open a ritual, you also need to close it. And that's it. Just as I said, 20 minutes. I like the example that we find quite common across Native American practices. You see, most of them, they believe that if you just sit someplace in a quiet spot, and if you have an issue, you take a pebble or a stone, a little stone in your hand, 20 minutes, they say. It doesn't take more than 20 minutes. You turn it on all its facets while you are thinking of your question, you know, or whatever is on your mind. And like you say, after 20 minutes, you will have your answer. Mm-hmm. Right then and there, fully fledged out, you know, so no other intervention is needed. So I kind of like the simplicity of these acts, you know, and I like the fact that you can get a message that is completely unmediated. Even when we talk about the cards, there is some kind of mediation, because obviously what we're dealing with is another person's hand, you know, who drew the images and all this stuff. But with nature, you know, we don't have any such other, you know, mediator between yourself and then the stuff that is just there revealing itself onto you, you know, as it probably has been out there in nature for ages, you know. So I like the ways in which perhaps even in my card reading, I always try to kind of bypass, you know, right, or not think so much about the person behind, you know. I'm just trying to see to what extent I can get a very direct message that is not so mediated, you see, by the drawing itself or by the colors even, you know.
Yeah.
That's many traditions who actually do like to talk about the importance of color, how we recognize that and what it kind of things, I don't know, unconscious feelings or unconscious learning, you know, that the recognition of color, you know, can enable us to get that. So, but you know, to me, that still requires a bit of interpretation that exceeds the directness of a message, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I kind of prefer nature.
Well, it's one of those things, you know. I think that Crowley says, you know, that the whole key to success in magic is to sit down, shut up, and get out, you know? And, you know, we can interpret that in many contexts. And I think that in our conversation, you know, this notion that if you can be silent, you'll get the answer. Now, getting to silent is very, very straightforward, but not necessarily very easy, especially when one is, you know, struggling with something, right? But I think that that's the key. And I think that with reading the cards, with receiving messages from nature, with working, you know, magic, you know, it really becomes this matter of can we be present and receptive, as opposed to sort of like you know active and interpretive, and then kind of go back and see where that takes us as a way of discovering it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, if we want to conflate the way in which people use the cards and then at the same time perhaps get down to the commonsensical, maybe even beyond. And then yet, I don't know, now we talk about Crowley, you know, what I like about, I like his poetry a lot. So, you know, but I also like what he was talking about. And how simple in a way the soul process is, insofar as it just relies on you wanting something badly enough, if you like, you know, the being flame. He had this notion of praying and having you know, a heightened state of passion, if you like. So the idea of being inflamed, you know. So how can you rationalize that, you know? So, but I find that in order for magical practices to work, and especially since, again, some would say, oh, this is tradition, you know, and then they make references to some stuff that was written in 1700, and then they say, oh, this is more kosher than what is being written now, because that was written in 1700, but then they forget that, you know, at that time when some of these magical practices were written down, there is no guarantee, you know, that what we are dealing with here is not just one person's opinion or one person's individual experiment, you know, and one person's own testing of a method. So, you know, so I'm always a little bit, I'm not so keen on all this talk about what's traditional or not, but I can just exemplify, you know, I the other day I had somebody telling me how, some work situation, you know, and they say, and then I took one of those destroyer cards from the tarot, you know, and since I have the key to my colleague's office, I simply glued it to the back of his chair. You know, so I was thinking, oh, you did? So, you know, so of course now, this is also where we enter the territory of what others call black magic, you know, says, oh, sure. So you have it for your colleague and he pisses you off. So then, and you happen to have the keys to his office. Oh my goodness.
Do you know if it worked? Did they get the result they wanted?
Well, that's just the thing, you see, because, the I don't want to say the funny thing because I don't even know what qualifier to add onto this, but it tends to work. But you know, you know why it works. It's not because this is a routine that is traditional, you know, or that comes from some kind of secret grimoire, you know, or secret manuscript or old scrapbook or whatever, Book of Shadows. No, it simply works because, you know, the person, while I can just, you know, I'm very visual, so I have to say I really laughed a lot. I could just see the person entering the other person's office and then gluing this destroyer car. I can imagine it was the tower, maybe, you know, on the chair. If you turn the chair upside down, right, so it can't be seen by the other in any way. So, you know, so it has to be placed in a hidden spot somehow. So, you know, I could just visualize this whole scene, and I thought, oh my god. But you see, I realized that if that kind of magic works, you know, sympathetically, because that's what we are talking about here, it's simply because the person was probably very inflamed, you know, they're very passionate about it, you know. So if the magic works, again, it's not because it comes from some kind of old book. Well, mind you, you know, sometimes it's easy to take on some other people's experience, you know, and say, oh, this has been tested. This really does work. So I don't want to say don't ever try that or don't believe anything you are hearing. Go, good for you, you know. But my feeling is that if it does work, it's not so much because of this tradition or lineage or because the recipe for a specific act, you know, comes from some secret book, but simply because of the one doing the magic's attitude, you know. So what kind of an attitude do you have? Mm-hmm. Are you inflamed enough? What does your prayer look like or sound like while you go about, you know, opening another person's door and planting, I don't know, these things into his courtyard, as it were?
Yeah. And, you know, maybe certainly for some people, the appearance, whether it's true or not is irrelevant, but the appearance of history and tradition sparks that fire in them, right? It's like, oh, I've got this, you know, I've got this book and it's old and it's, you know, and therefore it's true and, you know, and it's more real. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is some appeal to that, and I have to plead guilty, you know. I have a lot of old books, you know, because I like old paper. Let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't really go so far as to say that just because I make recourse maybe to something that's very thoroughly described in these books, my magic will also work because of that. So I would actually advance the claim that that is not it, you know. Sympathetic magic really only works because you are combining your own desire, you know, your own will, if you like, if we can claim we even have any free will, whatever you call it, just a kind of a drive. So you combine that kind of drive with a willingness to let yourself be open for what others have called, well, the underworld forces or dark forces, or, you know, I'm not so keen on all these distinctions with the black or white magic or dark or light. I mean, I don't really see.
I think telluric and astral is as good as anything, you know?
Right.
And maybe a collective unconscious. We could throw a third prong in there if we needed to. But.
That's it. So therefore, you know, it's whatever one thinks. In that sense, I think, you know, Hodorovsky, Alejandro Hodorovsky, he, in his book Psychomagic, I kind of like the way he goes about it, although I'm not always in agreement with the way in which he reads cards. But, you know, I like what he has to say about how we can all participate in creating and devising rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, bringing in a good portion of our own drive, you know, and then again, that kind of openness or willingness towards doing something that perhaps, let's just say, in other contexts, it's not deemed appropriate, you see, because, I mean, for once, is it even legal to go and bust into another person's house? So, you know, we quickly run into a number of ethical issues or, you know, right and wrong. But here again, we don't really need a bunch of philosophers of applied philosophy to tell us what the difference is between right and wrong. We all kind of know what that is. So, yet, you know, somewhere in order for magic to work, one would have to situate oneself on a higher level. You know, where we suspend, if you like, that kind of judgment. So it's a completely purely act that relies on, symbolic. It's a symbolic act that where the intention is also, you know, quite crucial in order for it to work. So mm-hmm. we have a level of symbolism, but at the same time, unless that kind of symbolic thought is not tagged with the very act, you know, the physical act that you are engaged with, then it's not going to work.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too how often people bypass their own ethics around these things too. You know, I one of my teachers said to me what I think is the best gauge. You know, because you know people can dance around and justify and rationalize things, but you know what he said to me was you know, simply, Would you, it was in the context of doing spiritual work for other people, right? And he's like, would you do that for them in the real world? Is this a friend that they could bribe you to go help them move their house? Well, then there's nothing ethically wrong with that, right? You know, would you go down the street and punch their enemy in the face? Well, maybe they, you know, maybe not. I mean, personally, probably not. Some people maybe, right? And that kind of converting it back into daily kind of things. But as you say, sometimes in that, I think this is what you're getting to, sometimes in that transgression, there is power too, you know, and that's where people get themselves fired up. And I can just imagine this person like looking up and down the hall and checking to make sure there's no camera on the door and sliding the key in and being like, you know,
exactly.
And just how sparked up that would be.
Yeah. But you see, I think that this is where some people go a bit wrong in terms of how they get to define magic as either being black or white. You know, somewhere I don't think the magic is either black or white. And in that sense, it does exceed all our so-called ethical concerns. I mean, the magic is fine as it is, you know. So where we go wrong is in the method, yeah. So, you know, we can easily approach a certain magical activity from the wrong end, if you like, you know, in terms of the method being rather dubious, you know. And so if I'm to ever pass any kind of judgment on what other people are doing, then I would not look at the so-called type of magic that they are engaged in performing, but I would look at their methods. I would look at their acts. You know, what do these acts disclose, even on that level of the magic? You know? So, and then that's when I would draw a line, and I would use my own common sense or power to discern, you know, and say, okay, this doesn't sound to me like it's very either useful or perhaps if it's questionable, then you just take a few steps back, you know, and say, Okay. And this, of course, if a question like that comes from somebody who would like you to perform something that you're not comfortable with, so I never go and I either judge the person or the magic as such and say, oh, I'm a sorcerer. I only perform black magic. I'm a specialist in black magic. I mean, if you look back in history, you know, we actually have, just think of the shamans, you know, if you think of the Siberian shamans, I mean, you know, they do fall into two categories, you know, some only performed healings and some performed this other stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like a job, you know, it's any other job, you know. So but again, who are the people who are willing to perform this? If you are cool with it, fine, you know. So, you know, and if you are not as a practitioner, you know, then you just, you send the person down the road and say, you know, I'm only doing healings. I'm not doing any of that stuff. I'm not going to, you know, shoot your neighbor there because he doesn't like the way in which your grass looks like.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and I was going to say something and now I lost it. Oh, well. You know, I think that the idea that, you know, when we're having these conversations too, you know, I mean, we can look at them on many levels too, right? Like, it just as the question that somebody asks tells you psychologically things about them, certainly the kind of magic that the person is doing or wanting to do certainly also really reveals a lot about that person too, which I think is always kind of interesting, you know? People, certainly I've had clients who have revealed things that I was quite surprised about. Not in the reading, not through the cards, not through our discussions, but at the end of the conversation when they're like, so I really want to make this happen magically. Can you tell me how to do that? I'm like, wow, that's interesting. Can we talk about that? Like, that's a very interesting revelation. So,
absolutely. Well, you know, these things always, the performance of a magical act always needs to be anchored, in my opinion, to a very specific context. And, you know, as soon as we match the act with the context, that's when it opens for us to investigate the extent to which we talk about ethical issues or, you know, can we judge this or can we suspend our judgment? Or, I mean, just to give you an example to concretize a bit, say, I've had people tell me, oh, really? So you live your life according to the cards, you know? And some people have a trouble with, you know, and I say, yeah, so you are a fortune teller and an academic? And I'm like, well, yeah, what's wrong with that? And that's it, you know. So I often don't deliver any other kind of explanation, and people always expect one, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course, as soon as I disclose some of my acts, again, which are very physical, but on another plane, one could argue, perhaps they can be said to have a metaphysical consequence, is when, say, I lay down three cards every day and I just get a sense of, just, you know, with my coffee, it has become a routine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a day going to look like, you know? What would be a good idea for you to do or focus on, and what would be a good idea for you definitely to not engage with, you know? So I usually have this very nice little routine. I lay down three cards for the situation. The one on top is what to do, and the one at below is what not to do. So it's basically a five card spread. So, you know, say I have a meeting with a suit at my university and I get the papers in the position of what not to do, you know, or sorry, what to do. Or it doesn't matter really. So if the papers comes in the position of what to do, you know what I do? I show up at the meeting and then I say absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, I say nothing. I just sit and listen. Now, what do we call that? So if talking about cards and magic, I would say that is a magical act.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I haven't even discovered what the whole context of the meeting is when my mind is already made up that whatever people will be putting on the table, politics mainly, you know, which doesn't really even interest me so much. It's all awful. So, but still, you know, one has a say in it. Because, you know, if they have a certain position and you have some authority. So I usually have a say in it, you know. So But, you know, what kind of choices do I make, you know? Of course, if I don't have a say in it, then I don't have that position available to me, so it doesn't matter that I end up saying nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But insofar as I do have a say in it, then I can see what kind of choices do I have. So if I get the Papesse card, then I just sit there at the meeting and say nothing. That's a magical act, you know. Now, some would say, well, but you haven't even heard what these other guys, that's not fair, that's not ethical, you know, you're not being very involved, you know, you're not cooperating. So I can easily see how such concerns may be voiced, and for good reason, you know, because, if, you know, I don't really have an answer to that, and I don't, so in that sense, obviously I'm biased, yeah? So how honest am I? If I go into a meeting already with my mind up to not say absolutely nothing. Yeah, I say nothing. So likewise, you know, if I get the emperor, I often sometimes get the emperor and say, oh, I'm so going to put my fist into this table now. You know, so I'm going to realize that grand plan, you know, it doesn't matter what the cost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually think about this practice that I have now been living according to for a number of years. You know, to what extent is honest or dishonest, or does it serve a good cause? And to what extent do I actually help the others on the other side of the table that I'm meeting that day when I just decided myself? So, you know, I have to admit that I am a little bit cautious with how arrogant, you know, my position is vis-a-vis the others, you know, in the sense that, oh, I already know exactly what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I have already made up my mind, because you see this implicitly what I'm saying is that I don't give the others the choice. So you see, one could easily argue that what I'm doing there is not very ethical.
But, you know, I mean, ultimately, to argue the other side here, you know, I mean, ultimately, really what you're doing is what we were talking about with the pebble trick, right? You know, the pebble magic. Mm-hmm. You are listening. You're setting aside time to listen, and then you are showing up and you're being engaged, right? Mm-hmm. In a way that suits you and suits wherever that information, spirit, you know, whatever the guidance is that comes through that cards for you, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody has that option. Everybody mm-hmm. has the option to meditate and to be engaged and so on. And so I mean, again, I could be rationalizing this, which is always the danger, right? But to me, this notion that, you know, that information is available to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Should they learn, right? Or should they have someone they can go and consult, you know? And those options are certainly available. So, you know, I don't think it's an unfair advantage. It's not, you know, steroids on the bike race, you know? It's like looking at the map before you get on the bike and being like, all right, so how am I going to plan my route today, and where do I want to push and not push, you know?
That's right. Well, you know, of course, maybe I would be remiss if I didn't say that I do use my common sense, even if I do look at what the cards may indicate at the level of action for a particular situation or context. So, you know, in that sense... it's not like, you know, I could say that I live 100% according to that. But, you know, if you bring the awareness into it again, then indeed, you know, perhaps what I'm thinking of while I sit there in the meeting and thinking, I wonder if I could say something now. You see, I often experience that. I could say something now. So see, if I hadn't looked it up in the cards, or if I wouldn't have any kind of in this to go on, yeah, and I would probably just open my mouth, and then yes, even for, you know, in spite of my better judgment, I may regret it at the end of the day. And that also goes for the opposite, when you just sit there and say nothing, and then the meeting finishes, and then you are just a gray little mouse who never says anything.
Mm-hmm. And then you take it home with you and think, oh, I wish I had said this and that.
Exactly.
And something else.
Yeah. So I think that personally, the reason why it works personally is simply because then I don't come home and speculate. See what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah.
So at least I'm free to then engage in some other activity, and I don't give it a shred of a thought, you know, I don't even for a split second do I think, oh, actually, yeah, you got the papas today, but my God, you know, that really called for a fist on the table. You should have said something, you know, you should have stabbed something. Where is the King of Swords? Yeah. So I'm thinking, no, I never speculate, you know, so I always just, you know, file it away, you know, and in a way, I think that the reason why I like to think of doing cards and magic in conjunction, it's because through the kicking in of this awareness, personal awareness, what we are arriving at, or at least that's what I strive for, is, you know, the tripartite wisdom, you know, understand, accept, and let go. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that situation where I come home, and then while I may speculate otherwise, say, at the end of a meeting, oh, you should have said something. Because I got the pup, I never do that. So I'm just thinking, I let it go, you see. So I always think to myself, oh, how wonderful. I'm already living a rather wise life.
Excellent.
I feel very good about myself, you see.
Definitely. I think, I never really thought about it that way, but I think that retrospectively looking at that kind of you know, daily practice and the ways in which I use the cards, you know, I think that there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. I don't second guess things. I don't, you know, by the time I'm around to doing it, whatever the action is, whether it's a magical thing or it's just like something around my business or with my kids, I don't usually reconsider or have those afterthoughts, because the conjunction of my presence, my awareness, the cards, and my common sense have kind of left me with something that I can hold on to. And I think that's one of the real powers of using the cards too, is that the way in which the visual symbol of it imprints on us, at least on me, and I think that I hear in you too, it imprints on my memory in a way that allows me to hold on to my decisions and my thought process. And then by the time I get to the end of it, I'm like, all right, so done this, and off we go, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. You get the sense of how your inner conviction maybe is enforcing your spine, if you like.
Uh-huh.
You just stand tall all the time. Although this is one aspect of it. And then there is yet the other aspect of magic and the cards, when we use cards to perform some other kind of an act that I would call a persuasion. And let me just give you an example, because as you're talking, I was just being reminded of it. About 2 years ago, I went to Norway. I always go to Norway for my summer vacation, and my sister decided to join us. So my partner and I were already landed there on top of a mountain. And after about 1 week, my sister was ready to have her vacation and then drive, a long drive from Denmark to somewhere in the middle of Norway. So you know, she just said to me, so how, she usually does the Lenormand, you know, and then says, how, can you look it up in the cards and see how is this long drive? I'm a bit anxious. So I can't remember exactly what, usually I lay three cards just for a quick reading, you know. I can't remember what the first one was, but I do remember the last two, because the way in which they made me feel, you know, and then the events ensuing after that. So she got the chariot, the charioteer, and the tower. Yeah. So I looked at it and I thought, oh, fuck. I mean, sorry. So I said, you know, it doesn't look too good, you know. You're going to have an accident, you know. So I freaked her out. So, you know, so I said to her, listen to me, I said to her, it looks like the situation is not too good, you know. I don't know about your driving skills so much. I don't drive with her a whole lot. So I said to her, and I'm not even sure that advising you to drive carefully will do the trick. So I just relayed the message, and I said, listen, I think you should take now. So this is the magical act. I said, I think you should take from the pack. You should take, I think I told her, the Wheel of Fortune, the will, you know, so again, quite literally, and the temperance. So I said, maybe what you need to make sure is that you can perhaps alleviate turn over, you know, what the cards are suggesting, that you're going to have an accident, by simply planting these two cards on your dashboard, in your car. So there's the Wheel of Fortune and the Temperance, so you can have a smooth, streamlined, driving. And this is where, although she is also into the cards, but sometimes when the cards can give you a very straightforward message that you don't want to hear anything about, and you are about to embark on a long drive and say, oh, I don't want to hear, I'm going to have an accident, bloody hell. So she completely dismissed my advice.
Right.
So sure enough, she hits the road after for 5 hours. She calls me from Garo. So I said, what the hell are you? And she goes like, she almost couldn't bring herself to tell me. She says, well, I'm sorry, but somebody bumped into me and I had an accident. So, and I got to the point, I said, you had an accident. That didn't surprise me, you see. Although, mind you, in a way it's like, oh, how nice, I laid three cards, and then they're so validating, wonderful, what a fortune teller you are, perfect. But I did say to her, so I don't get it. So then I said to her, what I'm intrigued is the fact that the Wheel of Fortune and Temperance, smooth driving, because now the other two cards are already in use, the Charioteer, which is very much for the driving. I said, I'm a bit surprised that you didn't get any help. And then she went like, well, I didn't really believe in any of what you're saying, so I didn't use the cards on my dashboard. So now you see to the $1 million question, right? What if she had used those cards when I told her? And then I said to her, I was almost ready to bash her, and I said, well, luckily nothing happened other than that the car had to be repaired and all that. And then there was a delay of a few hours. So, but what if, you see? So what if she had taken the advice? I almost got more pissed with her because she kind of ruined the chance for me to figure out how this accident could have been more mitigated, if you like, if she had used the magic, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's never really any proof, right? Like, I mean, that's the challenge with this stuff, right? I was working with someone and they were in a really bad financial situation, and I told them some stuff to do, and it was kind of strange because they kept complaining. They were doing the stuff, but they kept complaining to me, and I was like, really? Really? And then I talked to someone who knew them, and I was like, oh, I see what's going on here. You thought that you would score like the perfect job and everything would be solid gold. And meanwhile, you're not impressed by the fact that you're actually like keeping your house and eating and able to live in the face of this situation that certainly looked like it was going to utterly ruin you for, the coming future. And, you start getting into that. Did the magic work? Did it not work? Would have this happened anyway? How much do we control and all these kinds of things, right?
Yeah. Well, that's it. It only takes one occurrence, maybe also for people to learn the lesson. Mm-hmm. Because, since that time, now, first of all, my sister believes everything I say.
Yeah.
And second of all, now she doesn't dismiss the possibility that maybe empowering yourself, because it is a way of empowering yourself, by just sticking a few cards into your pocket when you need them so that you are awareness again. So there isn't really any power in the cards themselves other than the fact that you create a connection to the card, and when you stick it in your pocket with a very specific intent, you are very aware not only of how you are supposed to behave maybe in a certain situation, but also of the fact that you are actually going somewhere. So it's using the cards with a purpose. Mm-hmm. So see, that's where the power really is. So I was very pleased a few months after that event with my sister. She got a cat, and then the land owner, the one that owns the apartment,
The landlord, yeah.
The house, yeah, So she's clearly stipulated in the contract that no pets were allowed. Well, my sister, she decided she would have a cat anyway, and then she was a bit desperate. Says, "Oh, I have no idea how am I going to go over there and present this woman with the fait accompli. You know, I got the cat." So I said to her, "Okay, so here's what you do, right?" So again, I said, "Why don't you stick a few cards into your pocket? You know, those, you know, maybe Le Pape, you know, the hero of Antia. You get a Le Pape into your pocket. The Pope is always good with diplomatic relations. A good plea, you know, maybe the world, you know, like the cat means of the world." I mean, it's a very analogical kind of thinking, you know, between what you want to achieve on a very physical plane. What we don't talk about metaphysical concerns yet. And then, you know, at the other end, a potential that is merely there and you really don't have any kind of sense of in any physical form. So, so she sticks these cards into her pocket. So I said, "But don't do it." I said to her, "Don't do like the last time when I instructed you." So she took the cards and she goes over to the woman and she presents her with the situation. And not only did the woman say, "Oh, what the hell? Okay, it's fine." But then she also did something that was quite astonishing. Said, "Oh, by the way, I can see you also travel quite a bit. Just let me know when you are not at home. I'm going to go and mind your cat."
Amazing.
It's a little, you know. So there you have it. Now, obviously, of course, insofar as I don't have the other side of it, as it were, you know, it's like the cards work. You know, I can say now the cards work. So the question would be, well, what about the situations when merely sticking a card into your pocket will not elicit the same kind of positive result? That can also happen. Mm-hmm. But then I think somewhere, again, it's a concatenation of relations, you know, that make the magic work. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the very act, but it's also what that act activates in the person who engages in this magical act, you know, at the cognitive level, but then also beyond that, the Crowleyan idea of being inflamed, being passionate, you know, what kind of passion do you put into it, you know? And then, yeah, it does come down to the belief moves mountains, you know? Mm-hmm. you want this cat to stay in the house, you know, so there is no other option. So you're going to walk in there with this very intent, you know, of achieving a blessing, if you like. So, mm-hmm. And then you have, so I don't know. Yeah. Well, there are many examples like that, yeah.
For me, ultimately, it's a mystery, you know, just like reading the cards, you know. We can study them, we can do this, we can do that, we can think about it, we can try and explain it, we can, you know, we can, and, you know, I'm looking at your bookcase behind you, and all of those authors have tried to explain how it works with success in every case, you know, but not complete success, because ultimately, for me, you know, tarot is, and magic are mysterious things. It is the gas in the chamber at a certain point, and it's the thing that allows it to move ahead and make things happen. And, you know, it's where we've got to go along for the ride and say, at least from my point of view, was it successful? Was it beneficial? Was it helpful? Did it get me where I needed to go, whether I can explain it or not? And, you know, mm-hmm. to me, that ultimately is the magic and the tarot as well.
Mm-hmm. But you see, all these questions that you are posing, in fact, revolve very much around that which we are not very good at, stepping outside of your own head. You see, this is what I find, that using cards as magical tools, now that we talk about, you know, the sympathetic relation, I think that this is exactly what I appreciate, that they enable me to get out of my own head so that I don't sit there and speculate endlessly about a number of possibilities. As much as I like to do that, you know, I just don't see that at the end of the day, it gets me anywhere. So now I use the cards with a very specific intent or purpose, and I state that, and maybe I can even ritualize my going about that. But that's only because, you know, I kind of like incense, you know. I like to light the three candles.
Sure.
You know, kind of space. I just like joie de vivre, you know, in a way that kind of, it makes you feel good. It makes you relax. So you see, every time we step into that kind of ritual space, what we actually do on a physical plane is, in fact, getting in touch with our physical bodies, getting outside of the speculative mind, and perhaps, you know, living, accepting, and yeah, letting go, you know, those things that either you can't change or things that nag you, and maybe you don't immediately have a solution to. So, you know, stepping into a ritual space for me is equal to stepping outside of my head and being aware of how my body, the physical body, interacts with my physical environment. Do I hear any sounds? Can I smell these flowers I have on the table? Can I listen to my dog making some funny barking, or maybe giving me a sign of some sort that it wants something? Or, you know, so I find that the ways in which I get to interact with the world in this way, you know, it's much more rewarding than if I were to sit there and then speculate endlessly on this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that this is, I read cards. For some reason, women like to come to me, although I also read for men quite a bit. But, you know, women always like my, what they call the merciless style, you know. So I just lay three cards, and in 3 seconds they get the answer, you know. And I don't dilly-dally and say, ditch him, you know. So, and that's that. So I never really go into that speculative. Wait a minute, but you know, no, I've been thinking of this guy for 10 years now, you know.
Exactly. What's really in his heart? And what if this? And what if that? And yeah. What if I?
Yeah. So I always say, I'm sure you get something on that account, the fact that you keep thinking about. But you know, at the level of how you can do something for your own self that is not within that space, you know, that's merely within your own head, you know, in your own mind. I would say, ditch him, go out into the woods, have a talk to this tree that you encounter, get some cards with you if you like that, you know, or smoke something, mm-hmm. get stoned, you know, and I mean, this kind of thing, and just relax, you know, I mean, like the Buddhists say, everything is as it should be. So somewhere I like to think of my practice with the cards also in those terms, that there is no right or wrong, or you know, you just, but you can't, of course, you can't deliver a direct message like that unless you yourself are able to step outside of even your own experiences. I mean, obviously, all readers, we operate with suggestion, we operate with our own experience, so there is no way in which we cannot project our own experience onto the sitters or the querents. But when that is said and done, you know, creating that space between yourself and the one opposite you, that's mediated by these cards. And as soon as you take yourself as a variable into the situation, yeah, then the focus is neither on you, nor even on the cards, nor on the person. The focus is what happens at the interactive level. So, you know, all three are then balanced, or at least that's what I go for. Mm-hmm. Can I have a balanced sense of myself vis-a-vis the cards I'm reading and vis-a-vis also this person who has this question? You know, so as soon as I can get a sense of balance, then off I go. Now, of course, sometimes when we come across, as readers, come across people who have issues or problems, you know, I can also tell when somebody is, let's just say, either all over the place, they can't state what they want. They can't formulate a precise question. That's why I actually spend quite a bit of time on how we can formulate the question together when I see they have a hard time. And here the cards are so generous because, you know, often people sit with issues and they can't put it into words. Mm-hmm. So then you lay three cards down and then boom, it's there. So the cards are so very generous. But even before we get to that point, I think it's quite important that some very important information comes through the very process of getting the person to formulate a fairly precise question that is also honest, because, you know, often the questions are there. I also come across people who are dodging it, you know, and then they want to know one thing and then you know. So now, unlike other readers, they say, well, how do you, the person has a question, but the cards emphasize an entirely different situation. So I always say, no, I always go with the question. Yeah, mm-hmm. Not the other thing that the cards may emphasize, because there is always that other danger, you know, that you are going to be walking into the woods with no guide and you get lost. Mm-hmm. So I always, even if the...
Yeah. Or you just completely undermine the person's sense of self if they're not ready for that shadowy stuff, right?
Exactly. So, you know, so as a, if I am in touch with my own balancing act here, you know, vis-a-vis the cards and the person, then I also expect to have everything done as a symmetrical. I believe in symmetrical relations. I always talk about this, you know. That what I put in it, I also expect that you do the same, you know. So... but often people don't have that kind of sense of balance, you know. But so part of my work, anyway, or part of the what makes it a bit magical, if you like, is to get the person to really get a sense of the space. Where do you sit? How anchored can you feel even to that chair that you sit in? You know, can you feel that chair? You know, we feel that pull of the gravitas. You know, mm-hmm. Like let's get down to business here. You know? So I always do that kind of work before we even talk about anything else. And once I have a feeling that now we are all balanced, then we go. And it's a very rewarding act at the end of the day to just see how it's not just the cards and the message that you get, but then also the other person's having become aware of the fact that groundedness is needed, you know, or even when you approach your own issue or a question, from an angle, you know, you actually have to get to have a fairly good sense of what that angle looks like. Are you flying up there and are you all over the place, or are you fairly, you know, so that we can be on the same page at the end of this. So that's what I always, so to me, that's the magic. Can we be on the same page? Mm-hmm. All of the cards included. So, and that satisfies me. You know.
Excellent. Well, perhaps we should end this while you are satisfied.
A card, you know, it can take hours.
exactly, for sure. Well, I know that you write a lot and are around on the internet and stuff. If people who are listening to this would like to come and find you, where would you prefer them to come looking?
Oh, you know, given my name, Camellia Elias or Elias. I think there is only one other person in the world who has this name, so it's very simple. You just Google it, I say to everybody. Google my name, and you will be instantly directed either to my official webpage, my work, or Tarot Reflections, where I write about cards and the history of divination. So, you know, I'm very easy to find. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and all the other stuff.
Excellent.
I like the public space.
Cool. Well, thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. I hope my Transylvanian accent didn't get the better of me.
Oh, your accent was perfect. And let's hope Ryan is satisfied with our interview now.
That's it. Yeah, we have to greet him from here.
So thank you for listening to the Hermit's Lamp podcast again. I certainly hope that you're enjoying it. If you are on iTunes and would be amenable to giving me a review, that would be wonderful. Their star system certainly prioritizes podcasts and so on in the search engines, and I would appreciate that. Please do connect with me and let me know what you think, either on Facebook or via email. And if you're looking for more, there are certainly all sorts of options on my website, thehermitslamp.com, from other kinds of podcasts as well as classes, both recordings of previous events and future ones. I hope you're having a great day. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.